You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our weekly look at the American League Central, and it's a special week. The American League Division Series between the Cleveland Indians and the Boston Red Sox begins Thursday night at Progressive Field. We will preview that with Indians reporter Jordan Bastian and with Red Sox reporter Ian Brown. Elsewhere, we will wrap up the seasons for the other Central clubs, the Tigers, Twins, White Sox, and Royals. All of our beat reporters will join us to talk about the year that was and why those clubs did not make it to October. Thanks for tuning in. Here we go. This is our look at the American League Division Series between the Cleveland Indians and the Boston Red Sox. I am joined by Red Sox reporter Ian Brown, Indians reporter Jordan Bastian. Gentlemen, first of all, thank you for doing this. Welcome to October.
Good
to be seen.
Beautiful day in Cleveland. Yeah.
So, Brownie, I want to start with you. How big of a deal did you think for the Red Sox, from the Red Sox perspective, the final weekend of the season, losing home field advantage of this series?
I don't think it was a big deal at all because, the Red Sox had the best road record in the American League this year. Only the Cubs had a better record in all baseball on the road, and that was by half a game. So I think this is a good matchup for the Red Sox, first of all, against the Indians, just with the way Cleveland's pitching has been depleted a little bit, the starting pitching. So I think that's why John Farrell kind of prioritized just kind of taking care of guys the last weekend of the season. He took David Ortiz out in the fifth inning of, I think, a tie game on Saturday. So I think that kind of showed you where his head was at, where he just wanted to get his team in good shape going in.
JB, we'll do this like the vice presidential debate. I'll give you your turn to speak
point,
on that.
Counterpoint.
From the Indians' perspective, how big was to swipe home field advantage from the Red Sox in that last weekend?
Well, I mean, Sunday couldn't have gone any better from the Indians' perspective. They needed a very specific set of results to occur for them to get home field and not to have to go to Detroit for Monday for that possible makeup game. And everything fell in line perfectly from the Indians' perspective. They got home field in the ALDS. They didn't have to go to Detroit. And judging by how loudly everyone was celebrating in that clubhouse at the end of the games on Sunday, it was kind of a big sense of relief for the Indians. And I think it's important because there's a lot of young players on the Indians roster who are going through the playoffs for the first time. And if your first postseason experience is stepping into Fenway Park, that's going to be overwhelming. So I think that was a benefit for some of those guys where not only were they not going to have that hectic travel schedule, but they get a couple days off, they get to come home, they get to go through their routines, and then they get to open up in front of their home crowd, and they have the most walk-offs in the American League this year with 11, the best home record this year, and as we've discussed before, their offensive numbers at home compared to on the road are very drastic, drastic to the point where you would think maybe there's a little more to it than you would think otherwise. So I think it was important just for their mental side of getting that rest, getting back home into their routines, and not having to walk into just the chaotic atmosphere in the Fens.
Let's dig into some of the narratives associated with this series. Obviously, this is Big Papi's final season. Red Sox, trying to get him back to the World Series stage. How much has that kind of colored these last few weeks, the race in the AL East and running away with that? It's obviously been a big subplot.
Yeah, it has been a big subplot, but more because of all the ceremonies and just all of that. But I think the Red Sox themselves, David Ortiz has kind of set the tone where he's just worried about winning another World Series. He's not worried about, hey, this is my last go-around. So I think the young guys have kind of taken his lead, and they've kind of kept their eyes on the prize. Sure, they would like him to go out on top, but they're not, that's not their driving force. These young guys have never played in the playoffs, so they're just excited to be here after finishing in last place the last 2 years.
And another big narrative, of course, is Terry Francona going against his former club. He's certainly done everything he can do to downplay that narrative so far.
Yeah, I mean, every time he's been asked about his feelings about Boston, he's quick to say, this series is about the players, it's not about him. And as Ian can attest, I mean, that's classic Francona, trying to kind of take the spotlight off of him. He has said it's kind of bittersweet going up against Farrell. He's really lauded Farrell for the accomplishments, both what he's come back from personally and professionally this year. I think entering into the season, a lot of people thought, he was on the hot seat and going to be gone pretty quickly. So here they are in the postseason, two really good friends off the field, former teammates with the Indians. And, I think that's going to be bittersweet because he obviously loves to see Farrell succeed, but this week he's going to be trying to beat him. So, but yeah, Tito's done a good job of really saying, you know, from both sides, from Boston's perspective, from Cleveland's perspective, that the series needs to be about the players and not about his return. And, I mean, honestly, it's been so many years now. It's not like he, you know, led them to the World Series 2 years ago or last year, or the chicken and beer stuff is fresh on everyone's mind. I mean, that was a long time ago now. A lot of years have passed, and, you know, I think it's to the point where Boston fans give him a pretty warm reception every time we've gone back there to see him there.
What are your thoughts on the Red Sox going up against Francona? Obviously, you covered him for a long time.
Yeah, no, I think that I echo what Jordan said. And really, aside from Pedroia, Ortiz, and Buchholz, I mean, none of these guys even played for Francona. And as far as Farrell, it's funny what a disciple he is of Francona, because he's been saying the same thing where, you know, the focus really needs to be on the players. And but then, you know, he'll, like Francona, he'll get really in-depth on the relationship he has with Terry and the respect he has. He called, you know, I asked him the other day if, you know, where Francona ranked among his friends in baseball, and he said the top. You know, the top, and he gave a lot of reasons that, you know, we don't just share baseball stuff. We've shared health stuff on both sides, and you know, everyone remembers that Francona was the one who went to Farrell's first chemotherapy treatment last year. So these guys are, you know, they have a really unique friendship.
Yeah, it's, and this series is just loaded with personal connections. Yeah. We've been talking about it in the lead-up. It's kind of ridiculous just how many guys have filtered between the two organizations. You know, Mike Napoli, of course. Mike Hazen, the Red Sox GM, got his start in Cleveland, so... a lot of ties that bind there, but of course, all that really matters is what happens between the lines. JB, I'll start with you here. Just who is an X factor for who is the X factor in your opinion for the Indians in this series?
Well, that's funny. I wrote an X factor story on Indians.com. You can read all about it. Now, I think Trevor Bauer is very, very important. You know, this is a guy who started in the bullpen on opening day, and they were kind of sending him a message that just because you've trained your whole life to be a starter and believe you're a starter, you know, you kind of got to earn it. So they started him in the bullpen, ticked him off there for a little while. But, you know, due to circumstance, due to his performance, he made his way back to the rotation and has just steadily climbed up that rotation through all the issues that have struck this team. The most recent one being ace Corey Kluber dealing with a mild quadriceps strain. So that's why you see all of a sudden Bauer is the game one starter in the first postseason game since 2013 for this team. So I think he's going to be very important, especially if this extends beyond three games and he's got to come back on short rest, something they're very confident he's physically able to do. He did it earlier this year in a game in Toronto that went 19 innings. He had thrown a very aggressive bullpen the day before, was prepping for a start the following day, and instead on short notice, without even knowing he was going to have to, you know, came in and logged 80-plus pitches in five innings of shutout ball to help them win in a 19-inning marathon. So I think he's going to be pretty critical. And then just given the rotation's issues, I think the bullpen is going to come up huge. I don't think you'll see any Zach Britton-type situations in this series. I think if Tito feels Andrew Miller is the best option in the fifth inning on, you're going to see him come in, and then you'll see him mix and match with the rest of those guys. They have a crew that can really shorten the game, and that's going to be very important given the state of the rotation right now.
Brownie, your move, man. Who's the Red Sox X factor?
Yeah, I call it X factors with a parenthesis around the S. Because to me, Clay Buchholz and Eduardo Rodriguez, your number three and probably game four starters. Mm-hmm. You look at where these guys were at earlier in the season. You know, Rodriguez had like an 80 ERA in late June and was sent down to the minors. Buchholz was taken out of the rotation, I think, three times this year. And both of these guys just came up big for this team in the second half of the season to the point where you're actually kind of confident that they can pitch good games in games three and four. So it's going to be important because, you know, these are the guys that are pitching the home games. Mm-hmm. So you need to keep momentum at home. So you need Clay Buchholz to keep on that late season role he's been on. You need Eduardo Rodriguez not to get unnerved by pitching in the playoffs for the first time. So I think those guys are really important for the Red Sox.
Yeah, you know, the three of us were here in Cleveland on opening day, David Price versus Corey Kluber, and I don't think any of us expected at that point that would be the game two starters, David Price and Corey Kluber. But obviously situations lined up to where, obviously for the Indians' perspective, it was Kluber's health situation with the groin and giving him an extra day. What went into the Red Sox decision with Porcello over Price for game one?
Yeah, I mean, it was really more Porcello than Price. I mean, Porcello has been you know, one of the top three or four pitchers in the AL all season long here, and he's just been machine-like consistency, where, you know, Price had a pretty good second half, but he hasn't had that same consistency as Porcello. He's had off night here and there, and with Price, there's going to be a lot of, you know, a lot magnified in his playoff record going into that starting game too. We've been hearing about that ever since he signed with the Red Sox. You know, it's kind of risky to sign a guy for $217 million who has I think, no playoff wins and starts. He's won one game in relief. So is he a guy that maybe presses a little too much in the postseason? And that's why game two, I think, is going to be the most fascinating game of the whole series.
And JB, just a note on Josh Tomlin, because he'll be so, I mean, they got home field advantage, but I guess the concern there is Josh Tomlin in Fenway Park and his home run tendency. So note on Josh Tomlin, how he pitched very well down the stretch.
He did. He actually lost his job in the rotation at the end of August. He went 0-5 with an 11.48 ERA in August and was removed, you know. But then all of a sudden you lose Carlos Carrasco, you lose Danny Salazar. They really liked Mike Clevenger, their rookie right-hander, more as a reliever right now. They feel he's still sort of learning as a starter in the big leagues, but, you know, they've seen him more effective in shorter spurts. So that, again, last man standing, Josh Tomlin. But to his credit, he kind of got that mental break. He was able to really sit down and figure out what was going on. He got very cutter happy and kind of switched up his arsenal a little bit. You know, it was a little more evenly distributed over the month of September. And I think he had a 169 ERA off the top of my head over the last month. You know, no walks. Really looked like the guy he was earlier in the year when he started the year 9-1 with a low 3 ERA. So, obviously, there's going to be possibly some regression to the mean, but again, as we discussed about the Indians' bullpen, if they can get 4 or 5 innings out of Josh Tomlin effectively, they have the bullpen to make up the innings. I think that's what they're looking at right now as they go into that. But as you mentioned, very homer-prone. I think he gave up the second most home runs in baseball, or maybe at least the American League this year, and putting him in Fenway is a dicey situation. For a fly ball guy like that, but you know, the last month gives them that faith that, you know, he can at least be effective to the point where you bridge that gap to that bullpen.
Ronnie mentioned Tomlin is a sort of a question mark from the Indian side. From the Red Sox side, just given the way his season ended, Craig Kimbrell is a little bit of a question mark right now. Had trouble finding the strike zone his last few times out. What's the word on him going into this?
Yeah, he's had some real mechanical flaws lately. So they say he's getting rotational with his delivery, and he's worked a lot on that the last few days. They say that they're fully confident in him going into the playoffs. You know, they think that he's had enough time in between the end of the regular season to the first game of the playoffs that he's going to be able to fix this. And I mean, nobody works harder than this guy. But that is going to be a big focal point until you see him close out that first game. So I know Red Sox fans are going to be anxious about it until they see him lock down that first day. So I think that's a big talking point going into the series.
All right. Can I get some predictions out of you men? JB, you go first.
Well, you know, the fact that Corey Kluber is in game two, and then if it were to extend to 5, is their game 5 starter. You know, I think that gives them the edge if the series goes the distance. So I'm going to say Indians in 5.
Okay.
And I'm going to say Red Sox in 4, so they don't have to face Corey Kluber in game 5.
Couple of homers here. All right.
Yeah.
I want to thank Jordan Bastian and Ian Brown for joining me. Should be a fascinating series, the American League Division Series between the Red Sox and Indians. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras.
Jeffrey, obviously, this was not the year the Royals won it. This was not the follow-up to the World Series championship. And yet, you know, we know in this game how difficult it is to follow a World Series championship with another. Royals fall short of October. The wear and tear of the last two postseason runs really seemed to reveal itself this year on the injury front and in some cases on the performance front.
Yeah, I think you really hit it on the head there. I think what I witnessed was just a team that just kind of got wore down. They were able to kind of get it together and make a great run in August, at one point winning 18 out of 22. But eventually just kind of ran out of gas. Lorenzo Cain got hurt again. And, they've had Moustakas out for most of the season. Alex Gordon's missed a bunch of time. Just all the injuries that you didn't see happen to this team in 14 and 15 all caught up to them in 16. And I do think there was some emotional fatigue, too, just from the long runs in 14 and 15, playing all the way till November. And I didn't think they could sustain it all year energy-wise. And as it turned out, the tank was empty.
Yeah, and you think back, you know, as late into the season as I'd say early to mid-June, it still felt like, you know, the Royals had that edge and, you know, bound to repeat as AL Central champions. But at the same time, I think when Mike Moustakas' injury, when he tore his ACL in late May, that seemed to be the one that was really, boy, you really start to think, okay, this might not be the year for the Royals.
Yeah, there's certain guys on this team that are, you know, for whatever reason, are irreplaceable. You would start with Salvador Perez, and Lorenzo Cain's another guy who's an igniter. Their record with him and without him is amazing, those splits are. And the other guy is Mike Moustakas, who I think they really missed. He was off to a terrific start. He had, I think he had 7 home runs in early May when he got hurt. You know, you project that out, he was headed for a 25-30 home run season. And Chesler Cuthbert's done a great job filling in for him. He did a great job filling in for him, but he's just not Mike Moustakas in terms of leadership, what Moose means in late innings, and all the big hits, the big home runs that Moose got. So going forward to 2017, Ned's talked about this many times down the stretch, is that he cannot wait to get a healthy Mike Moustakas and a healthy Lorenzo Cain back.
Yeah, those will be like free agent additions in a sense. You know, one guy who was a free agent addition, surprisingly, was Alex Gordon. That was a big deal for the Royals to be able to re-sign Alex when it was – they went into last offseason. It seemed like everybody was conceding the fact that he was going to go elsewhere, but they were able to work things out. But, you know, Alex Gordon just wasn't Alex Gordon this year.
No, he wasn't. And, you know, he never said this out loud, but I could tell in the last few weeks he just could not wait to just flush the 2016 season and start over next spring in surprise. And I think I'd fully expect him to bounce back and have an Alex Gordon-type season next year. He's just too good of a player, too talented, takes care of himself too well. Every athlete out there in the world has an off season, and we just saw it from Alex.
You mentioned Chesler Cuthbert and the job he did filling in for Moustakas. Whit Merrifield really stepped up for a team that DFA'd Omar Infante midway through the year at second base. Paulo Orlando really stepped up in some big stretches with Alex Gordon on the shelf. The Royals showed their depth a little bit this year with some of these guys making unexpected contributions.
Yeah, that's certainly going to help going into 2017, too. And, you know, another guy you didn't mention was Raul Mondesi, who's their top prospect, who got a lot of playing time in the last couple months. And that's going to be immeasurable and as he goes into spring training trying to win the second base job. But, yeah, all those guys you mentioned, Cuthbert, Orlando, Whit Merrifield, all got a lot of valuable experience that will help the depth of this team going into 2017.
Another thing that will help is Danny Duffy in the rotation. And you look at the rotation, a huge step forward for Duffy. And also Ian Kennedy was kind of a panned free agent signing in the industry, and he really did well for them as well.
Yeah, he really did. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that was one of those contracts that everybody just kind of scratched their head at. Go, what are they doing? But he was, you know, throughout the course of the season, I'm talking about from opening day to end of the season, he was probably their most reliable guy because Danny didn't join the rotation until May. So they got their money's worth out of him for sure. And, you know, coming back to next year, you're going to have him. You're going to have Yordano Ventura, and another guy that we haven't mentioned is Jason Vargas, who finished strong down the stretch coming off of Tommy John surgery. So the rotation that looked pretty bleak, you know, maybe a couple of months ago going into 17, looks pretty decent right now with those four.
Merck, it's the way it started. I can't believe that we're here at the, you know, outset of October and the White Sox are not involved. The way they started the season 17-8, they had such great pitching in that first month. They had such great defense, and it just felt like something that had the potential to hold up.
Yeah, you know, I wrote this in our kind of in our season wrap up, for WhiteSox.com. They were 23-10, and I think the Sox are probably sick of hearing about them being 23-10 in 6 games and fun in first place at that point. But if they would have just played 500 baseball the rest of the way, they would have gone 65-64 in the last 129. You know, they probably wouldn't have caught Cleveland, but they certainly would be right there. Even a little below 500 would still have them right in the wild card picture. You know, and it just didn't happen. They had some key injuries, but it's not, you know, you can't use that as an excuse. I think one of the things is they just had, as Robin termed, too many gut punch losses this year. You know, there was a game in Texas right after the next day after they had their high watermark of 23-10 and got 6 games up when Todd Frazier hit an extra inning grand slam to give them the win. And they blew an 11-5 lead, I believe it was the 8th inning, and I think Ryan Rua hit a home run to beat them, and they gave 8 runs in the 8th. They had that classic moment, classic in the wrong way, in Kansas City where they were up 7-1 in the 9th and blew it, lost the game in the 9th in regulation. There's a game in Seattle out of the All-Star break where Sale had a one-hitter through eight innings, and David Robertson gave up four runs in the ninth inning, and they lost. And it just was that stretch, really, where they went into the break, the last series before the break. They had a 44-41 record. They lost two out of three to Atlanta, who was not, you know, who's had an awful year, although played much better down the stretch, but was a pretty bad team at that point. Lost two out of three at home to Atlanta, got swept by Anaheim, who was kind of in the same boat as Atlanta, and then lost two out of three to Seattle and lost the first two of a four-game set to Detroit. And really kind of all bets were off at that point. So, yeah, it was really another – I thought last year was rough, and this year was rougher, I think, because it had a little bit of hope and then just went so far sideways. You know, not even, like I said, went from first place to, okay, they still have it. They need to win five of the last six, and they can force a tie with Baltimore or Toronto or whoever. They just fell off. You know, they were out of it for pretty much the entire month of September. So it was full of promise. It went from full of promise to full of pain, sort of, for 2016. I don't think they're going to use that on the cover of their highlight, you know, their wrap up. But that still is kind of how what happened.
That's exactly what happened. And you know, Chris Sale and Jose Quintana had such great seasons atop the rotation, and you know, there's individual element there that I'm. You know, Jose Quintana finally gets a double-digit win total, and Chris Sale really showed his durability, his ability to go deeper into games. So that's great on an individual level, but just from a team-wide perspective, you think about the seasons those guys have, they really went to waste.
Yeah, you know, Jose Quintana, for those who believe that win-loss has zero to do with the pitcher's success, Jose Quintana is the guy you want speaking at your conference when you have that, because – the fact that, you know, this is the first year he's won double digits is amazing, because he's been one of the most consistent starters, let alone in the American League, let alone for the White Sox in baseball during his tenure in the rotation. And what you just said, Anthony, is the argument of why some people would like the Sox to go into a rebuild, because, yeah, you know, my argument is you can say, well, you have these pitchers, that these are the kind of pitchers you want. These are the kind of pitchers that teams pay hundreds of millions of dollars for, or maybe not hundreds of millions, but $100 million for over 6 or 7 years, and you have them already for great contracts, and you have control of them for a couple of years. But the caveat is, well, you're not winning with them, and you're not really coming close to winning with them. So what do you do? Do you use these guys to try and build up a system that even the Sox admit is getting better, but still not strong, still not full of depth, still not where, you know, if you have a couple injuries like the Sox have this year, four or five injuries, you have decent players coming up to fill the spots, but you don't have dynamic players coming up and fill the spots. So do you use them to make the trades and kind of build that up, or do you try and, you know, reinforce what you have and build around the core of Sale, Quintana, Rodon, Tim Anderson, possibly Carson Fulmer, Adam Eaton, Jose Abreu? Is that what you build around? So it's what Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams have to decide going into the offseason, you know, what their plan is going to be. And it may be a plan that's fluid. It may be a plan that they say, we're going to look at this and explore deals, and they may not get near what they want for Chris Sale and Jose Quintana, and then quickly have to change and say, okay, let's go for it then. Let's see what we can add on and build this team up. Because, you know, when you trade these guys, you can't trade 80 cents on the dollar or even 90 cents on the dollar. You got to get more than their value, really, in return. And you can't settle. This is not a salary dump. It's a rebuild to help, you know, make this team strong again, and you have to treat it as such.
Brett, it was just not the way any of us expected this to go, especially coming off the major strides the Twins made in 2015. You expected a step forward. Instead, a huge, huge step back for here in 2016. How do you sum up a year like this?
Definitely disappointing, like you said. I mean, this is a team last year that, you know, was in contention to the last week of the season, you know, eliminated on the second to last day of the year. This season, that 0-9 start kind of really put them in a tough spot and never, ever able to recover. The pitching has definitely been a big issue this year, the worst ERA in the American League. The offense has been, you know, at least decent. Obviously, we've seen some amazing performances from guys like Brian Dozier. The bullpen has had some issues, too, in terms of some breaking some new guys in and losing some guys to injury. Guys like Glenn Perkins obviously missed the season with labrum surgery after only a few appearances. Trevor May was supposed to be a big part of that bullpen, you know, had a bunch of back injuries on the DL three different times. So the injury definitely played a role. And some of it, too, was just some of the younger guys that are hopefully take a big step forward didn't really make that step. You know, Byron Buxton had a nice September, but overall struggled, you know, especially early in the year. Miguel Sano wasn't quite as good as he was in his rookie year either. Some of the guys like Eddie Rosario, too, had to go back down to the minors to work on things. So a lot of things went wrong, obviously, to have to, you know, to endure a 100-loss season. So certainly wasn't what they were expecting, and sure enough, obviously it cost Terry Ryan his job in July. So definitely an important offseason coming up for the Twins, because it was definitely a very, very disappointing overall season for Minnesota.
Yeah, Rhett, when you reflect on that, you know, obviously the Twins have been a very loyal organization. That's been their reputation for a very long time, and Terry Ryan was there for a very long time. So I think that kind of sums up the year right there. If it was bad enough that Terry Ryan could not survive this year, I think that kind of says a lot. As you reflect on the magnitude of that move and things moving forward, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, I mean, Terry Ryan's been part of the organization for a very long time, since the 80s, his second stint as a GM. The organization's been very loyal, and Terry was loyal to them, too. And the big thing with Terry was every year his contract was year to year. He didn't have a five-year deal to be the GM or anything like that. So I think it surprised him when ownership came to him in July and said that he wasn't going to be back. I think he kind of assumed that he would be. When they said no, he said, well, you might as well, you know, fire me now to kind of at least get ahead with this GM search. Was, you know, typical Terry, and certainly the right move for him and even for the organization to kind of to move forward in a sense. We'll see, obviously, if it pays off and everything. But it sounds like, as of right now, the Twins won't confirm it, but Derek Falvey from the Indians, assistant GM, looks like he's going to be taken over now as the head of baseball operations. He's also expected to hire a GM as well to kind of work underneath him under that kind of a system here. Falvey's very, very well-regarded, kind of brings a new voice to the organization, certainly much younger than Terry Ryan in his 30s there, 32, 33, a young guy, but certainly someone that's worked in every facet of the Indians front office. Very, very well-regarded, so we'll see what he can do as the new president of baseball operations going forward here.
You know, when you reflect on 2016, so much of the Twins' offseason strategy revolved around Byung-Ho Park. He comes in as the DH. Miguel Sano moves out to the outfield to accommodate Trevor Plouffe at third base. Well, none of those things worked out. You know, Plouffe had a rough year. Sano had a very rough defensive go in right field. And Byung-Ho Park optioned out at the start of July, finished the year in the minor league DL with wrist issues. Just a really tough situation all around.
Yeah, the Twins really wanted to kind of inject some offense and thought that by signing Byung-Ho Park, which was a reasonable deal at the time, made a lot of sense to kind of get his bat in the lineup as a DH with that kind of power. And then it allowed, you know, Plouffe to play third, his natural position, and have Sano move to right to kind of keep his bat in the lineup instead of having him, you know, DHing all the time as a 22, 23-year-old. Seemed to make sense, but at the same time, asking Sano to go to right field definitely did not work out at all. And one of those things, kind of in hindsight, looking at a guy who's 270 pounds, making that transition, you know, in hindsight, it looks pretty obvious that was a bad idea to do that at the time, especially having watched him play out in right field and the inexperience he had. And then on top of it all, Park really struggled, you know, especially falling into a slump there, going to AAA, dealt with kind of a wrist-slash-hand problem the entire season, ended up getting surgery there at the end of the year, which I'm sure didn't help his overall numbers either. And just, you know, the overall transition to the majors and also just to America was a lot for Park to deal with. So, yeah, it was tough in that sense. And Plouffe, too, was supposed to be part of that solution at third base, and he had a lot of injuries with his obliques. I think he landed on the DL three different times and was obviously out for the season, you know, most of September. So, yeah, it was a tough year, and we'll kind of see how they kind of plan to solve that this offseason, you know, to see if they believe that Sano is, you know, more of a DH type or if they think he can play third. Do they trade Plouffe this offseason? A lot of questions, the logjam in the middle infield. They're starting corner infield. Even Kenny Vargas actually had a pretty solid season in a short time in the majors, so he's still kind of in that mix too. So when you got those guys and obviously Joe Mauer as well, you've got a lot of corner infielders in this team. I think the new front office will have to kind of decide what the best way to be to kind of fix that logjam.
Ultimately, the Tigers' bats just got shut down, and they didn't get any help from the teams in the AL East.
Yeah, it was kind of anticlimactic, I think, was what I was feeling after all the travel possibilities and all the tiebreaker scenarios. It just kind of fizzled out. I think you go back to that Saturday game against Aaron Blair and the way he pitched against them, you know, with the strikeouts and everything. I think that was kind of a letdown for them. I think they expected a tough battle with Tehran on Sunday. I'm not sure they were expecting what they saw out of Blair. I think his performance caught them off guard. He got them to chase off the plate. And you know what? Miguel Cabrera was up front afterwards saying, yeah, he he got us a chase and we never adjusted. You know, blame us in part for it. You know, he pitched well, but we also didn't catch up to him.
Well, you know, the offense, you know, it was obviously riding high going into those couple of games there in Atlanta. But really, this is an inconsistent offense all season. I guess it's maybe a fitting end there the way the last couple of weeks played out.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how an offense that I think the previous six games they were averaging like six runs a game. It might have been exactly six runs a game. And to get what little they got there, and I know, you know, it's an American League team and National League City, and you don't have Victor Martinez in there, and that's a big bet out of your lineup. But still, I think you expected more out of them in those two games. J.D. Martinez fell into a slump probably at the worst possible time. He made some hard contact on some balls, but, you know, he had the double play in the eighth inning on Saturday. He had six consecutive strikeouts, I think, during the string between Friday and Saturday, something like that. They were healthy. But, you know, Nick Castellanos, even though he was back, was still getting his timing back. He was maybe even a little better than what you would have expected from a guy who hadn't seen much live pitching outside of instructional ball for almost 2 months. And it just, it really kind of was a letdown. And you wonder if it'll have any impact on what, if anything, they decide to do in the offseason. It's an offense that when it's on can mash a lot of good pitching and can put up scary run totals. But it also seems prone to deep slumps that they struggle to get out of. And when you have quality starting pitching, which they have the makings of, certainly going into next year, you can weather some of those slumps, but you wonder if some of these swings were a little bit too wild for their liking.
Obviously, Beck, 2015 was a really disappointing year, and it led to some really hard decisions at the trade deadline, and it seemed like the Tigers were taking a competitive step back at that point. But then they took a major step forward in terms of the effort to contend for 2016 in terms of what they did in free agency last year with Justin Upton, with Jordan Zimmermann. As the season is over at this point, you kind of reflect on 2016 as sort of the autopsy report of what went right and what went wrong here. What's your kind of final analysis of why this club didn't make it back to October?
Well, I think it took a while, but the starting pitching eventually went right for them by and large. Justin Verlander, I think, bounced back and then some. But I think just as important, maybe if not more so, you had the emergence of three quality young starters, which I think gives them an awfully good foundation, those four guys going into next season. What went wrong, and I think I wrote about it, besides the peaks and valleys of the offense, I think you can look at some of the offseason acquisitions, and they didn't have the impact you would have expected going into the season. Mark Lowe really was a non-factor all season. He was pretty much put in the back of the bullpen for mop-up duty for all but maybe the opening month. Jordan Zimmermann had a historically good opening month, then battled injuries, never quite found his form from there. Mike Pelfrey, I think I did the numbers. It was like four quality starts in 21 or 22 outings, just amazing ratio of just mediocrity. And I think the step forward they thought they saw in him just never quite came to fruition. It really was. You know, now, Francisco Rodriguez, I think, by and large, worked out. He had his ups and downs, and certainly that blown save against Kansas City down the stretch is something that's really going to haunt these guys for a while. But I think, by and large, he was a success, but there were a lot of pitching moves there that really had either mixed or negative results.